Matt, alcoholic. And timer's ready. All right, I'm going to get my watch here so I know when to get sober. My talk, I'm definitely an alcoholic, and, you know, and I'm going to, what I got, 40 minutes, right? And just 30? I'm just looking, just checking. Okay. All right, I was told 45, 30, it's cool. I'll kill that time either way it goes. 40. Okay, 40 it is. I'll get sober in 20 minutes. You know, but, you know, I wanted to just thank Daniela for asking me to come talk. I've known her for a long time, and I know her because of AA service. I also like to congratulate people who had their anniversaries. I know you always hear that. Oh, it's really great, you know, but... I had over a year sobriety, didn't even know it. So the person that got nine months, props. You know it, that's good. You know, and 8 years, well, I figured it out by then. The only reason I did is, I'll just tell you the story real quick, is I was in rehab in one of these after screw-up meetings at the hospital where I got sober, and the guy comes in and says his life's going really good, and his wife's happy, the baby's a year old. And I said, that baby's a year old? And he said, yeah. I said, well, you had that baby when I was in treatment, right? Yeah, well, that means I got a year of sobriety then. All right, you know? And I swear to God, that is the truth. I had no idea. But, you know, I always like to start off my talk with some real basic information. You know, I've been sober 24 years. It'll be 25 in August. I haven't gotten drunk on a weekend. I haven't gone out on any big pill benders. You know, I've been had a sponsor all this time. You know, a few have died. I've gotten new ones. You know, I go to probably about 5 meetings a week. Maybe 3 to 5. But you know, I'm a big advocate of the steps. I'm a big advocate of the sponsorship. And I'm a big advocate of the service work. So in case you remember, oh, that's that mad guy. I don't like that guy. You know, I mean, it happens sometimes. You can just know that if you want to stay sober a couple of decades, you know, the way to do it is you make AA a part of your life. You know, more importantly, not a part of your life. You make, for me at least, I've made the AA way of life is my life. Now, and I just want to emphasize that, you know, I'm not like hanging out in Al-Anon clubs, tackling people off, you know, bar stools and trying to get them sober. You know, what I try and do is live the AA way of life. But before I get into that in much more detail, you know, I want to tell you a little bit about what it was like. Because, you know, I got to remember, number one, and that's getting harder to do. And then number two, when I got sober, I wasn't looking to be spiritual, you know. I wasn't looking to make amends. I wasn't looking to... you know, reach some new academic and financial threshold where I would come out on top of my fellows. You know, nothing like that was going to happen. You know, what it was is I was sitting in the back row, you know, clowning with my buddies, and somebody said something that struck a chord with me, that struck a truth with me. And I could say to myself, I'm like that person. And that somehow, that some way, that was like the seed that grew some hope. Because I listened for another 5 minutes or another 10 minutes or so on. So for me, in a general way, what it was like, you know, I moved to Arizona from Michigan. Before that, I lived in California. Before that, I lived in Michigan. Before that, I lived in California. Before that, I lived in Michigan. And, you know, and my old man liked to move a lot. And I remember each time he moved, I was just heartbroken every single time. But when we got to Arizona, I was like, this is it. I'm like, I don't know, 12. And I'm like, I'm not moving again. And that's where it's going to stay right here. If I got to run away from home, I will. By the way, I want to thank my first speaker. My memory is just shit. So the first speaker, thank you. Thank you for your truth. And God bless you, man. And I hope you stay on the path. Sounds like you are. But I remember getting to Arizona, and I had a mom that was in AA. And I remember... you know, there's something on the TV, just say no, or something like that going on all the time. And I had a brother that was like, you know, wrecking cars and marriages and relationships. And my dad used to tell me, if you do drugs and drink, you'll end up like your brother Chris. And you know, God bless my brother Chris, man. He's still hitting it hard today. His life sucks, but he's still hitting it. But, you know, anyways, and I used to think, you know, that's a good idea. Intellectually, I thought drugs, alcohol, bad. But, you know, as soon as I found a place to drink, as soon as I could drink, like, you know, enough to get me to that place where I didn't know where I was going, but I sure as hell liked it when I got there, which was under a bridge. Now, in Arizona, it's mostly, as some of you know, really hard to dig. There weren't a lot of bridges back in 80-something, okay? But I did find a bridge to drink under. It was a spillway that went under a golf course. So I'm down there with my buddies, and I'm drinking, you know, Mickey's Big Mouse. And I remember about 5 or 6 Mickey's into it, I came up from under the bridge, and I had my girl's 3-speed bike and my my brown OP shorts and corduroy, I might add, and a Hobie shirt with the little, you know, ship on it. And I thought I had it going on, you know. And I remember rolling up to the local, you know, pizza place next to the high school and laying my wrap down with these girls. And I still remember I had like my finger through the belt loop like this. I was like, ah, blah, 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 you know. And I still remember that. And I felt so damn good. And somebody came along and ruined it and said, hey, man, we got some more beer. Do you want some? And, of course, I didn't say, I'm good. The buzz is great. No, I didn't say that at all. I said, hell, yeah, I want some more. Whatever I got, it's making me feel like I am right now. And give me some of that pizza while you're at it. So I did that. And a theme that repeated itself a few times in my drinking happened that night where I was out in front of the girls puking my ass off in the grass, you know, and they're looking at me, and I'm just sick as hell. And I remember going home. And I'd like to talk about some of these experiences because I think it's really important that, for me, this is the place that we have these moments where we got to face the people in our lives that are accountable or accountable to or accountable for us, as it was my case. But I remember, you know, riding my bike home, and I couldn't stand really, but I could pedal, and the bike would kind of go straight. So I made it home, crashed on a curb, landed on a pile of fire ants, and was laying there, and the fire ants getting the shit bit out of me. And I remember, you know, brushing them off and seeing my place, and I could see where I lived. I'm thinking maybe I'll stay here in the fire ants. But I got up, and I kind of leaned on the bike and kind of pushed it home, much like you might do if you're, you know, doing something else. And I remember standing at the back door, and this is like the first time I had to really put my game face on for the people that I was accountable to or for or whatever. And it was my parents. It's 11 o'clock Saturday night, and they're in there watching TV, and I'm all covered in puke and bugs and shit. And I remember opening up my eyes as wide as I could and straightening myself out and walking in. Hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. Feeling pretty tired. I think I'm going to go to bed. Good night. And I remember just kind of, you know, trucking up the steps, and I got up to the steps, and I could see my bed, and that's all I needed to do was see it, and I just kind of like fell towards the bed, and I guess I fell kind of half on, half off, and my dad came in the room later, and I faintly heard this voice, I'm like, what, Matt, get up, and this is what he's saying, and as I got up, you know, I was really good at coming up with stories about what happened to me. It was pretty plausible, some of the stuff I would come up with, but all that came out of my mouth that night was, ate a bad donut. And that was it, you know, because there was a donut shop right next to the pizza place. So, and I know it's funny, but, you know, the next day, you know, I wasn't thinking about, oh, God, I'm such a horrible man, boy, you know, I got this drinking thing going on. My dad said, you know, you shouldn't do that again. And I said, yeah, you're probably right. But in the back of my mind somewhere, that little light switch had been turned on. You know, and between that space that I had coming out from underneath the bridge and puking, I chased that little bandwidth of feeling until it was gone, until I couldn't have it anymore, you know. And over a period of time, I became everything that Alcoholics Anonymous talks about. I mean, I really mean it. It wasn't like, you know, yeah, I was institutionalized, I was jailed, and I probably was near death a few times. I had no idea. And the book talks about, you know, the family afterward, two wives, two the employer, you know, the people that surround the alcoholic. And for me, you know, I was a real son of a bitch to be around when it was between drinks, you know. But, you know, and I did a lot of non-habit forming marijuana too. But that's just part of my story. Pardon me. But I remember, you know, being between drinks and just being so agitated and so angry and so unhappy. And my little brother, who I love, would come up and say, "Hey, what's up?" And I'm like, "Leave me alone," you know. And I remember striking him at one point in between those times. And the look of betrayal, the look of terror, the look of absolute brokenheartedness on his eyes. I couldn't identify all that. All I saw in his eyes was him reflecting this horror in me. And I the first thing I did was run to the drink. You know, I couldn't get my hands on some whiskey quick enough. And I like drinking whiskey. You know, this crap whiskey called Evan Williams straight out of the bottle on a hot summer day. I love that shit. But, you know, not because I really had a choice, mind you. They kept the Evan down low where I could steal it. The JD and all the good shit was up top, you know. So, you know, I would take the Evan and ease my feelings. And I remember that feeling I had with my brother. And then along came a lot of other things that got progressively worse, you know. In AA and rehab and all this other stuff, you always hear about the progression. And for me, you know, I just got to look at my enrollment time within high school. I went from, you know, enrolled high school to dealing dope at school to kicked out to getting us kicked out of the place we lived in. Because between drinks, I would become so antisocial. I would do things like, you know, with my father. You know, I wondered why in the first year of my sobriety I got more fistfights with my dad than I did the whole time I was drinking. I'll tell you why, because I discovered it in an inventory process that I would stand out in front of my house and tell my dad, "Hey, fat ass, you know, if you weren't so fat, you could come get me, and why don't you come on?" And I would get him running around chasing me in his underwear in front of the neighbors, embarrassing himself. It's just a fury of rage, and I'm surprised the guy didn't put a bullet in my ass, to be honest with you. But you know, so later on I discovered the truth. But you know, I remember that kind of thing. And now I want to say another part of my story. I think it makes sense for people, at least it makes sense to me. Was, you know, there came that day when I came home and my I was out of weed and I was out of alcohol and I was pissed off, and it was a hot summer day. And I remember my dad saying something to me, and I just in a fit of rage, like, "F you, old man, if you could catch me finished." And I remember seeing him, I could see the rumble. It was like a thunderstorm erupting. And I was like, "Oh, he's pissed." And then I thought, well, I'm going to make my break for the front door. And then I realized I was too far up the steps. I'm never going to make it. So I started running from my bedroom. And, you know, and I remember I used to put the ski pole behind my doorknob. And my mom would beat on the door. "I know you're smoking weed in there. Come on out," you know, and doing that kind of shit. And I'd say, just turn up the stereo like I didn't hear. But, you know, I would literally do that. And I just reveled in being such an asshole then, too. But I remember my dad, he wasn't having it anymore. And I just had the ski pole up, and he busted through the door, and he was cracking me over the head with a ski pole. And my brother, I just found this out quite recently, too. My little brother was sitting on the bed watching the whole thing. He's like, "Yeah, bro, I saw the whole thing. It was crazy." So what happened was, and I think this is the point where the alcoholic steps in and the sane rational person says later. Because the sane rational person probably would have just taken the beating, "All right, I'll deal with it." But not me, man. I was like, I saw the window open, and I just had this feeling inside like I always wanted to try it anyways. I got up, I ran straight for the window and drove head first right out. Didn't think, and I'll be totally honest with you, I kind of enjoyed jumping straight out that window, man. I liked that feeling, you know, except when I got out a little ways and I started going down like that. I remember hitting the ground, and I hurt my ankle on the way out, I hit it on the windowsill. My dad looking over the edge of the window like, "Is he dead?" And I'm looking up at him and saying, "Oh, fuck you, old man, I hate you." And he was laughing, actually. He couldn't believe I did it. He was kind of laughing. He's like, "Oh, I'd throw this at you." And he just went back inside. But, you know, the insanity of that moment, the fact that, you know, I would continually agitate this man and continually just challenge him and antagonize him, you know, and then expect, "Oh, I'm supposed to be, you know, this." Anyways, that's what happened. So a few more things tend to happen. Enrollment time gets shorter. I go from go to another town, and again, we didn't move because my parents thought it was a good idea. We had to move because I was such a pain in the ass. You know, we had these double doors in this place we lived in, and I would like to run up to them, kick them as hard as I could and bounce off and make sure all the neighbors could see. I was just full of fury. And so we had to move, and then my enrollment time went down to like no time at all in school. And then eventually I became institutionalized and I was made a ward of the state. And at the time, you know, again, most people think this sucks. But, you know, when they locked the door, I thought, I'm safe in here. I'm good, you know. When they locked that door, I thought, I can sleep good tonight. You know, I was crazy, you know, and I remember sitting in jail and I was like totally, my head was so spun out from all the drinking and all the other stuff that, you know, I couldn't remember how to divide or subtract or any of that stuff. I just was like, I would look at numbers and they just wouldn't make, they wouldn't move in my mind or something. I couldn't figure it out. But eventually I went to a new institution from there and the fog cleared a little bit and I became a religious leader in jail. And and I was, you know, making deals with Jesus, speaking in tongues, and I had an orange penalty shirt on and a white collar. You know, I'm running around, a little religious leader there. And but I will say this, you know, and I don't mean to knock Christianity or any other type of practice somebody may have in this room. I tangibly felt something going on in my life. It did have an impact on me. But when I got out, you know, I didn't seek communion with God. You know, when I got out, I said, where's Jimmy Hernandez and my other shitbag buddies? And let's grow that weed farm we were talking about and get on with our lives. And that never happened either. So fast forward, you know, I'm in the center for male prostitution in the city of Phoenix, hitchhiking. And some guy picked me up immediately, of course, and said to me, the alcoholic, do you want a party? And the answer was, absolutely. So off to the other side of town I went, and I'm sitting on the other side of town, and this guy's like, hey, man, you want another beer? I'm like, yeah, I want another beer. And, you know, I want to say this, and I don't mean anything rude by it, but I literally think this is the one time alcoholism saved my ass, because I'm in there drinking with this guy, and he's showing me all these weird magazines, and I'm like, yeah, that's cool, man. You got another beer? And so I drank him out of everything he had, and I remember getting up, and I was always making these proclamations that I needed to get more booze for all my friends that were never around, you know. I always had, like, this romantic notion, like, oh, my friends, they mean so much to me. They were never around. They mean shit to me. You know? I remember I went out, and I stole a bottle of whiskey, and I came back, and I drank that. And I'm sure the guy was thinking, any minute now. And then I stood up again and went out the door, and this time they were on to me, the Super X drugs, me and my down jacket on a 70-degree day and the big hippie boots on. And again, here's the alcoholic, okay? Maybe I'm just crazy, I don't know. But I know they're watching me, and I got the bottle of booze, and I'm like, I better put that thing back, go get molested across the street or something. So I put it back, and then I'm walking out the door, and all I got to do is walk out the door, and everything's going to be good. That's all I got to do. But right at the last second, my pride grabs me by the asses. You better grab a bottle of eye drops. It might do some good later. I grab them like nobody's even looking, shove them down my pants. I get tackled at the front door. So Adobe Mountain Boys School, here we come again. It's basically boys' prison. And this is the second time around in here. You know, now I'm in an orange jumpsuit wearing flip-flops, living in a little tiny cell with some other dude, and I'm thinking, maybe I got a problem, but I doubt it, you know? And that's alcoholic in its own right, you know? To seriously suspect you have a problem, but at the same time completely deny it. So, I'm getting sober soon. You know, so I got out of jail, and I'd been through a lot, and a lot more than I'm not telling you about because I only got 40 minutes. But I knew in my mind that I liked to go to the bathroom when I wanted to go. I knew I liked to walk outside and see the stars. I knew I liked to watch TV and have a good time and just do anything that emulated freedom. I knew that was precious to me. You know, wars are waged over freedom, you know. But alcoholism, in my experience, has no regard for my freedom. It's like a time bomb ticking in me. And if I'm not doing, like our first speaker said, something about it, some steps, some work, you know, I am in trouble. Because I wasn't making deals with Jesus anymore. I wasn't doing anything like that. What happened was is that I ended up, you know, just totally freaked out and totally, like, just trying to toe the line, white-knuckling, as they say. And, of course, I couldn't take it after a while. I heard about a party that started at 10. I arrived at 7, you know, and started drinking. And then some guy showed up with a bunch of speed, and I did that at 11. And at 1 in the morning, I'm looking for a job, trying to get my life together, you know. And, you know, and I'm walking to 7-Eleven. Hey, man, can I get an application? You know, at Safeway, you know, same thing. You know, some guy trimming trees in the desert in the middle of the night because it's too hot to do it during the day. I'm asking for part-time work at like 1 in the morning. Stupid. But I got home that night and I sat on the edge of the bed and I said to myself, I feel real good. Got a lot done tonight, feeling real good. You know, and my whole life was complete wreckage. You know, it was complete and total wreckage. And, you know, my mom, I hit my mom, you know, in a fit of rage between drinks. You know, my brother wouldn't even talk to me anymore. I'm not even on probation. I'm on parole with the state. You know, everything in my life is, I know where I'm going next, which is prison. And in the back of my mind, I don't want to go on like this anymore. So I got up and I started to puke like I always did. And I was like a bulimic in training or something, but I would just puke and go back to bed, and I thought everything was okay. And I couldn't stop puking for some reason. And that wasn't the first time that had happened, but for some reason the sun was coming up. My mom came into the bathroom. She's standing over me, you know, and I look up at her. I don't know why, you know. She'd been kind of like trying to coax me into like a rehab or something for a while, and I said all dramatic, "Mom, call St. Luke's. I'm going in," you know. And as soon as I could hold down a glass of water, I thought, okay, maybe a smoke a joint will take the edge off here. So I went and smoked that joint, and a guy came up to me in this park and asked me, you know, "Hey, have you seen my stolen property?" Which, of course, I had in my pocket. And I said, "No." And he went on his way, and it was an overcast day, kind of like it was this morning. And I remember sitting in this park, and nothing catastrophic happened to me. You know, nothing horrible happened to me, no lightning bolt from the sky. But just a general sense of just complete and utter heartbreak and disgust in myself just was upon me. You know, a moment of clarity, a moment of just like, my life sucks, you know. And, okay. And I went home and I said, "Treatment tomorrow? Fine." 6 feet tall, 135 pounds, camouflage pants, horizontally striped shirt, you know. I'm in. Let's go. You know, and that's like a look I think I saw today on the street getting coffee. But, you know, and I thought it was cool back then. But I remember getting in treatment, and this is where I'm getting sober, don't worry. And that was August 10th, 1983. And I remember going into treatment, and I was like, all right, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to do this thing they say. And this is, I don't make this deal for anybody else. I made it for me because my life was at an end. You know, it wasn't like it was going to get any better. There was no trust fund going to come in from on high and swoop me up for 10 years of complete and utter chaos and belligerent abuse. You know, the state wasn't going to put me in a special treatment plan, nothing. I was going to prison, or I was going to just take my own life because it sucked anyways, you know. So I said, I'm going to give this AA thing 100%, and if it doesn't work, I'm going to take my own life because I don't want to live it anymore like I've been living it. Now, that might sound like happy AA horse shit, but I swear to God it is true, you know. And I went in and, you know, and I did what they said, you know. And I got, I went to their meetings and I talked about this and we got into groups and I just said, I'm going to dive in. Let's do this, you know. And I came out of rehab like 3 months later. I was 6 foot, 285 pounds. All I did was eat and work out for 3 months. And I became a genuine menace to society. But the only edge society had going for it and myself was that somebody had introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And in the course of that, you know, I went out and got the really cool sponsor to get like the let's say, the Clancy of my area at the time. But he wasn't a very tolerant man, Mr. Jim Highway. Jim fired me shortly after hiring me as a sponsee because, you know, he told me I was wrong. I said no, and we yelled at each other and hung up the phone. But he was nice enough to introduce me to a step study group where I did find a guy that was really helpful to me named Dan Clement. Now, I'll use these guys' last name because they're dead. But, you know, Dan was a big Chuck Chamberlain fan, and he kind of came from that real gentle, long foresight, vision of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he could always see past my chaos. And I come over there and say, Dan, I'm like 16, 17 years old, like flipping out over something. And he'd say, listen to all my babble. And then he'd say, let's open up the book and see what the book says. And he'd read something out of the book. It would apply to my problem in my life. And I'd say, I can do that. And I would be going to these meetings, and I used to think, where are all the cool people? I would have killed for a meeting like this where all these hip-looking people were. Because I was in these meetings, I had no car, a skateboard, and a bicycle that I borrowed from somebody else. That was my mode of transportation. And people would say things like this to me, and me say, get numbers and call people for rides. And I'm like, this skateboard shit sucks at 110 degrees. Give me your number. And I would call people, and they'd be like, he's actually calling me, And can you give me a ride with me? Okay, And then some people I'd call, no, don't call me anymore. You're bugging me. And the next people, I'm drunk, and want a party and whatever. But the thing was, I would call to go to meetings. And the people that would generally pick me up were people that would go to these big book studies and these 12 and 12 meetings and these meetings where they were in the book. And I used to think, well, but I'll tell you what, I would sit on my hands and just like grit my teeth and go through these book meetings, and they would make, and people would talk about their lives, and they talk about what's in the book, and then they talk about how they applied it in their book, and I would say, yeah, that makes sense to me. And from that, I had some hope. And then one day, I went home, and I had my usual fist fight with my dad, and I went out to the park, and came back, and I would go to this park called Kiwanis Park in Arizona. And in Kiwanis Park, I would just sit there and read my big book. Because honestly, to swear to God, I just had no other inspiration to read anything else because I was just so crazy in the head. That was the only thing I was into, was my big book. And I would sit there and read it until I felt better. And again, that probably sounds like a Hallmark horseshit, but I swear to God it's true. I was just too stupid and lucky to realize anything else. I didn't have any grand plans. So I went home and I told my dad, Dad, I'm not going to squander away any more hours that are worthwhile fighting you. And he was like, huh? And and I never fought him again. And when my dad died, he was a good friend of mine. I was a good son to him. And it wasn't because I went to, good son training. We had encounters together or whatever. Although that might be extremely helpful to some people. What I did is I kept going to AA, and I kept applying the principles in my life. And what happened as a byproduct of that was a good relationship with the people that were around me. And everything went well for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous until I hit 7 years and I compromised my honesty for something I thought I wanted or needed. And before I knew it, I couldn't stand AA. I couldn't stand you. And I couldn't stand myself was the truth of it. And I quit going to meetings, because I didn't want to be, I couldn't even live the double life. I couldn't stand myself. And I remember I got myself in a position where, I was weighing like 240, driving the couch around the living room, eating chocolate cookies, not paying any bills. I had a partner in pity with me, some bust out from a halfway house, and he was like, dude, it's cool, man. I feel you, bro. So we would sit there and drive the couch around, and all that stuff I did before that got me into Alcoholics Anonymous, all that step work, all those book studies, all of it was just like I couldn't get through this vapor lock of just self-pity and hatred I had for myself. And, there came a point where I ended up asking myself that question again, are you willing to go to any lengths to be sober? Are you willing to do whatever it takes? And I remember I said to myself, I got off a plane, went to see my brother in Hawaii. He thought I'd been drinking. And I sat in his place. It was a rainy day. And I thought to myself about that question. I said, yeah, I think I am still willing. And I called AA and I said, I'm an alcoholic. I got 7 years sober. And if I don't go to a meeting, I think I'm going to get drunk. And somebody drove out there, picked me up, took me to an AA meeting, and I resumed my front seat position in Alcoholics Anonymous, put on the dumbass hat again and said, I don't know nothing. I proved that for the last year. Time to hit restart and just get back into it. Now, I want to just say this. It's crazy as I got in that short period of time, I got progressively better as soon as I started reapplying the principles of AA to my life. And everything was really good. I hit about 11 years sober, and I was right all the damn time, I might add, at that point. You know, not only I'd been through this little bump in sobriety, I thought I was Mr. AA at the time. So nobody could tell me nothing. My mom, by the way, who had been in AA at some point, and I wanted to say that I respect anybody's individual choice to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're here because you're an alcoholic, more power to you. But if you decide you don't want to be in AA and you want to go out and experiment, you want to go out and do some more research, more power to you. And that was exactly what my mom did. But I didn't give her the right to do that. I didn't give her the right to be a human being and have her autonomy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Mr. AA was a self-righteous, indignant, unkind, condescending member of AA who would just, you know, power play the book and power play what he knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was right in the middle of an inventory around that time, and I realized that, wow, I am an asshole in a big way. And you know, and I thought, I gotta get this right. And I remember my mom had asked me, I was going to Europe on a vacation I always wanted to take, and she'd never been to Europe and just wanted to have a bottle of perfume from Paris. I remember grumbling about it under my breath, but I got her that bottle of perfume and I came back. And I gave it to her. And then a few weeks later, she was admitted to a hospital and had a spot on her lung, and they had found cancer, you know. And I remember thinking, well, my dad, you know, he had a long battle with cancer. He almost got through it. You know, I know I've been an asshole to my mom. I have plenty of time to be cool to her and try and, you know, be a good son to her now that I realize I really haven't been Mr. AA. But she didn't stick around for that. She decided that, you know, she didn't want to live through the suffering my father went through and practically willed herself to death in like 3 weeks. I never had a chance to tell her I was sorry. I never had a chance, more importantly, to act like a good human being to her, you know. And you never know when they're going to go. And that was an experience I had to take with me into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still carry with me today. You know, I want to hit on a couple other things, too. How are we doing on time here? I got my watch in front of me. 5 minutes? What, 10? 7? 10? Perfect. You know, I'll get to that in a minute, but at 18 years sober, you know, and by the way, you know, I have made a tremendous amount of mistakes in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to grow up in AA. You know, I've been heartbroken. You know, I've been a heartbreaker. You know, I've been cheated on. I've cheated. You know, I've screwed up on my taxes and blew it off for 2 or 3 years, and the IRS said, hello, we remember you. You know, I've been fired from jobs. You know, I've had great successes. You know, I've traveled. I've been in love. You know, I've done all this stuff. The point I'm getting at, you know, I've done well in school. I've done well professionally. I've sucked in school. I've sucked professionally. I've done life, you know, and I continue to do life today. I don't really consider any type of acquisition of a goal or ascending to a certain level any type of success. I look at life as an unfolding experience for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, that anywhere you're at as a human being is a part of that success, whether you're on the downside of it or the up. It's part of the life experience. I'm kind of getting out there a little bit, but you know, it's something I've been thinking a lot about the last few years. But at 18 years sober, you know, I was in love, and I had some people in AA that I was very close to betray my trust and conspire to really be hurtful. I got that. And it really, really shook me to my core. And I remember I didn't drink, but I felt awful. You know, I felt unsafe in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was so caught up in my own agony that I couldn't see AA as a whole. I could only see it as Matt saw it. And I had to go to a lot of meetings where I was assured of my autonomy. I would go to meetings where I didn't know anybody, you know, and I had to get back in touch with the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous is about, you know, about an individual's experience in AA. But, you know, people in AA, I'm sorry to break the news, but the well ship has not landed here, you know. You know, it is, their people are screwed up. And a lot of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have the very bad habit, and I've done it myself, of starting to develop a double life. You know, the AA appearance we like people to see, and then the kind of deals we cut for ourselves. And a lot of times, you know, I did this where I would surround myself with people that co-signed my bullshit. And that wasn't working out, obviously, because at 18 years sober, I was really, really in a hurting place. I was heartbroken, and I felt totally freaked out, and I didn't know what to do. And I remember sitting on my shower floor so broken and crying and begging God to please help me. I don't know what to do anymore, you know. And I'd been Mr. AA service. I'd done all this stuff for young people's conferences. I'd sponsored guys. I was sponsoring guys then. I had the great leadership in AA help me out. But I was heartbroken and broken as a human being. And I crawled back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to get some therapy. I had to do a few things outside of AA to get my head back on track. But you know what? I did. And life, after that, it was like the catalyst for a new kind of adventure for me. And what I've been calling it the last few years is kind of like floating, where I just said, you know what, F it, I'm done making plans. You know, it is driving me crazy. And all my plans did was get me into a whole lot of pain. So I ended up moving out of Arizona, my home base, the place where I got sober and did a lot of my early experience. Do let me know when I got 5 minutes, please. And I moved up to Northern California. I lived on a little island up there called Alameda Island right next to Oakland. And I found this meeting hall called the Island Fellowship. And I went to meetings there, and I just sat down, and I started being a regular member of AA again. And it was a very healing experience for me. And I lived there for a couple of years, and then I had this urge to move south for some reason. So I did. So here I am. And really, the urge was about kind of, you know, I went down to my buddy's place, stayed there for a month, rode my bicycle to the beach every day, ate a burrito, and jumped in the water. I'm like, this is all right. I got to live like this. So, you know, up there, I was like, sharks, water's cold, F this. But, you know, but when I got down here, you know, what I did was I got in the service again. You know, I went down to, you know, I went down to the International Conference of Young People in AA's host committee elections, and I sat down and I said, hey, I'm available to serve for a position if you'll have me. And I didn't know anybody there, and I thought, they're never going to elect me. My buddy Jimmy Moss is like, they don't know you. They're not going to elect you. I'm like, I know, but I just thought I'd throw my hat in the ring. Sure enough, they elected me. And I had a really unique opportunity to be of service. Now, throughout my sobriety, and I want to hit on this in the last 5 minutes or so, is that, you know, service has been a certain dynamic in my life that has given me joy that I can't even describe. The act, I mean, in the St. Francis prayer, it talks about, you know, being selfless, you know, comforting others, you know, understanding instead of being understood. And for me, that theme of service kind of walks along that same line. When you're doing something for another group or another human being without expectation for reward or recognition, there is a certain catalyst that happens through that. I can't really explain in much depth, but it's a beautiful thing. You know, and I had an opportunity to really do a lot of work there and be a part of that experience. And all of my experiences in AA, you know, from helping to found and start the Western Area Conference of Young People in AA, WACKYPAW, which was here a few years back, to more recently what I just mentioned, to my experiences on general service. All of that has been such a great thing in my life. And in the self-centered alcoholic, we just can't get our hands around the thought, like, all right, I'm going to go over here and do something for somebody else, and I'm going to spend my time and energy and my gas money and my smokes doing this for somebody else, and I'm going to feel better. It doesn't make any sense. But the funny thing is we do it, and all of a sudden we walk away and say, we feel better. And that's what I do today. You know, I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous. I participate in AA. You know, I got sponsees that... And I'm not bragging here. This is like Mr. Sponsor, the sponsors, these guys that I sponsor today, I regularly thank them for their, I regularly thank them for being in my life because I learn tremendously from those people, you know. It gives a certain thing, a certain fold to my life that I just can't get by self-examination. But when I tell you, hey, look, I think the problem here might be this, and you should probably critique that, and let's take a look at this, and then they leave, and I go, well, maybe I should take a look at that and critique this and do something like that myself. You know, we can't live, you know, give that advice and then go ahead and not live it ourselves. It's a recipe for insanity in my experience. You know, today, right now, I got up this morning. I do the 85 through 87 in the big book. I read that little piece. You know, I do the St. Francis prayer. I've been doing some Tibetan-style meditation. And I do a little daily reflection, you know. And I do all this stuff in AA. And I sound like such the AA dork. But I swear I do it because I just feel a little better and it sets me for a better day. You know, yeah, and then an hour after that, I was pissed off, stressed out, and unkind on the phone. Sorry, Brandy. You know, but, you know, the thing is that, you know, I participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the AA way of life. I said this real recently, and I want to just emphasize it, that Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life that I thought about leaving seriously when I had that 18-year bump. I thought about other ways of life, other things I could do. And this might sound like a redundant theme, but I'm just going to say it anyways because I'm a speaker, damn it. Is that I thought about what is the one characteristic that really, really impacts people in Alcoholics Anonymous? What's the one thing all these different practices do, whether it's Christian or Hindu or whatever? It's teaching, helping others, being selfless, being compassionate. And the thing was is that I thought, where in the hell am I going to find such a great opportunity to be helpful to my fellow man like I can in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I concluded, I can't find anywhere. I can't find people. It says right in the book, we can help when no one else can. We can secure their confidence when nobody else can. You know, that bond that we share, that precious thing that we have with the fellow alcoholic, I encourage everybody here to grab a hold of it again. And if you're not doing that selflessness, in my experience, you're missing out on a big, big piece of AA. You know, you can get laid, you can get paid, you can get all your other aspirations answered, but when it comes right down to it, there's a certain thing that happens when you do that that you can't acquire. It has to be done. So that's all I got. Thank you.